Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Pet ownership in America has increased over the last 20 years, a lot. In 2015, there were 185 million cats and dogs in America. By 2021, that number jumped to 200 million. And with that increase has come more businesses and products catering to pets and our love of them. But ask anyone who has one and they'll say their animal friend isn't just a pet. They're a member of the family, not some calculus on a balance sheet. Mark Cushing is a longtime political strategist turned animal advocate. His 2020 book is titled Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks.
You know, you open up the book with reference to something that I go through every day when I'm walking my dog in the park, and that is the relationship that having a pet helps you build. I mean, we've always kind of heard those tropes about people meeting somebody with a dog in a park kind of a thing, but it's a real deal. And the way you described it was immediately familiar to me.
Well, it's interesting. And there was the term is social capital, which is what are the activities, the relationships that build a community or a neighborhood. People feel less isolated, less fearful. They're not so much strangers. They're confident. They get engaged. A study was done in Perth, Australia, replicated in San Diego, Portland, Oregon, and Nashville. And it was a blind study. It didn't set out to prove anything about pets. It wanted to find out which factor had the greatest impact on social capital, churches, schools, sports, civic engagement. I'm sure not politics, but they tested it. And guess what? Pets won in all four studies. And they redid the study in Perth. There was that much surprise about this. But the more you think about it, two people walk down a street without a dog, they often don't even exchange glances because there's a sense you're invading the space of the person you're walking by. You stop for 15 minutes with dogs and talk, and you don't talk about where you went to school. You don't talk about money. You don't talk about your car. Nothing of kind of that sort that makes people suddenly separate themselves. It's all about what's her name, what's she like to do, what's she like to eat. And that is, you know, part two of the real story of pets, which is what they do for people individually. And we can talk about that because that's the human animal bond at its best.
Exactly. I mean, people we meet in the park, we typically know their dog's name immediately, and it can be sometimes months before we'll take the time to say, by the way, what's your name?
It's true. And it's one of the places I think is its greatest force is a city you'd least expect, right? Manhattan in New York. And my brother, you know, lives in New York, and we've seen it so often. You cannot walk down a New York boulevard, Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, doesn't matter. And there'll be a squadron of Afghans heading your way, six Afghans with a dog leash behind them, somebody trying to keep them in gear. But people are comfortable. They like it. And in a city of the greatest differences of wealth and success, as we measure success, all that fades away when it's just two people and their dog. And that's part of the magic of pets and why the most dramatic impact of what I call Pet Nation, the evolution of our culture with pets, the most dramatic impacts played out, namely what? Dogs are everywhere now. Mm-hmm. If there's any difference between now and 30 years ago that you want to put your finger on, you know, what do you mean? We always loved pets. Now, you know what? We liked pets. A lot of people loved them, but not everybody. Now, hospitals that forbade pets 30 years ago, you know, you'd have a nurse racing down a hallway to chase a dog out the door. You can't find a hospital that doesn't have animal-assisted therapy dogs. They're actually part of the treatment plan. Who could have saw that? Or hotels, a classic Marriott's pet-friendly, biggest hotel group in the world. And they didn't do it because they love dogs. They do it because they love business. They like to have people want to stay in their rooms and people want to go with their pets. So it's remarkable, really.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about pets, our relationships with pets, and how they've changed our culture. My guest is Mark Cushing. He's founder and CEO of the Animal Policy Group, which advocates for animal health and the veterinary profession in the U.S. He's also author of the book Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy. If you want to join the conversation, we'll be taking calls later on in the program. The number is 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. The shelters were being emptied during the pandemic, but that was just an acceleration of this ongoing trend. 7 in 10 Americans now own a pet. Most of them are dogs or cats, although there's a whole other conversation to be had about more exotic pets. But what was the turning point of this trend? Were you able to detect when we sort of turned that corner from liking to love?
Yeah, I developed a theory based upon part of it, my own lifetime, but just studying it and being involved in the industry the last 15 years. And it goes like this. There's really two components. When baby boomers were kids, you began to see pets come inside the house. And the impact, besides pets having a better night's sleep and being warmer, which I'm sure they appreciated, was that people spent a good deal more time with their pet. It wasn't, you know, out in the garage or out in the backyard, and you went home and you played for 10 minutes and so forth. And what that did was trigger the experience of what now is a scientifically proven, unquestioned fact that your oxytocin level, the source of pleasure and relaxation and calm, goes up around a pet, and your cortisol goes down, which is a source of stress and anxiety and worry. And so people began to experience that. And that merged with media. And I give media most of the credit, and it's both commercial and commercials and TV shows and movies, but also something I'll say in a minute. And a lot of that was sparked by the greatest dog in the history of the world, Lassie. And Lassie was a mainstay at 7:30 on Sunday evenings. And you saw this incredible collie just do things you can't imagine. And everybody wanted the dog. I mean, everybody was like, "Mom and Dad, can we have one of those?" And then all the cartoon dogs and Ren 10 10 and all the various dogs emerged all around us. And we saw this model of dogs as different. They were funny, they were fun, they were loyal, and they weren't accessories. And I call the pre-Pet Nation period, when dogs were sort of accessories, they were a sideshow in culture. And then it culminated in the 90s with remarkable commercials. I can't imagine, really, the vision that the ad agency had. I have to give them all the credit for. Subaru and Nissan ran ads, and the only thing you saw was a car on a California coastal highway, window down, retriever in the passenger seat, hair flowing in the wind, a big smile on his face, and you didn't learn anything about the car. And I imagine the CEO of those two companies watching these ads ahead of time going, "Well, you're not finished, obviously. You know, when do we hear about the engine, the mileage, and all the things?" And the answer is, you don't. This is it. We just show a dog in your brand, okay? And then things happen with people. So, and that combination, and then what lit fire to the whole thing was social media. So people, you know, get with smartphones that we didn't have, you know, earlier than that, began to take their own, make your own movies, if you will, their own films every day about their cat or their dog. And it was like, we didn't have an announcement one day, go love your dog or your cat, but it just began to surge. What's carried it over the finish line, I know you're in Ohio, so football analogies are welcome, right? So what really got it over the finish line, though, was when millennials, who were the children or grandchildren of baby boomers, yeah. And I have 5 kids of my own, they always had been around pets. So they got out of college and it was like, "I want a dog. I probably want 2 dogs." The other ones that got a second dog during COVID or a first time cat and so forth. And it became a surge, and it's never going to stop, is what I really emphasize to people. This isn't a fad. It's not like we're going to get bored with our pets. Because you think millennials' kids are going to have fewer pets than they had as children? Don't think so. So that's it was kind of a wave of events And now it's like a machine or, you know, a truck rolling downhill. It's not stopping. And it's interesting to see where it goes.
I guess, you know, the only reason why I might have thought it was not a fad, but a one-off in a way, is because it's expensive to have a pet now. If you're responsible, everybody wants to make sure they take their dog to the best, or their pet to the best vet they can. They want to, you know, they leave no stone unturned. They, you know, it's like typical now that the fresh pet food refrigerator in the grocery store sometimes is routinely sold out. Everybody's buying that. It's expensive.
It is. Though I'm not sure what's not expensive in 2021.
Well, I think
in
of somebody just graduating from college and being able to afford that. I certainly couldn't. I mean,
Here are the facts. This data came from 2015, so it's 6 years old, but it's not, you know, 20 years old. And Americans with household income of $30,000 a year or less own dogs at the same rate as those that had made $100,000 or more. So the point is, you can get dog food that's less expensive. You don't have to buy every gadget. You don't have to have a $400 fleece bed, because, by the way, 75% of pets sleep on top of your bed anyway. So, right. You know, why waste the money on a bed? So it is expensive, but you can manage it. It's a challenge, though, now. I talk in the book about what always surprises people, the shortage of dogs we have. The price of dogs themselves has escalated dramatically. That's going to be a pivot point that we've got to watch very carefully, to where dogs themselves don't become luxury items, regardless of what, you know, medical care and amenities cost. So it's a fair point, but the truth is, people make sacrifices. In 2008, you know, the real estate recession that we all, mm-hmm. you know, try to forget, but we can't quite forget. Pet ownership didn't decline. People sacrifice vacations, new cars, home remodeling, all the basics that we spend quite a bit of money on. Those were pushed back, but people didn't take their pets to shelters and say, here, you know, I can't afford Fluffy anymore.
Did you find that I was worried in 2008, 2009, that there would be a lot of that, that people would be having to, because a lot of them lost their homes and rentals typically are not pet friendly. You mentioned, you know, Marriott has become pet friendly. Are more apartment, are more rental corporations more pet friendly?
I laugh because of where you are. Are you in Columbus or near Columbus?
Right. Well, yeah, right in Columbus.
Okay. Oh, great. Well, we're going to have some fun now, because my team did a study in 2015, and we determined the most pet friendly or non-pet friendly cities measured by apartments that are pet friendly in the urban core.
Okay.
And to people's surprise, two cities that pride themselves on their pet culture, Austin, Texas, and Columbus, Ohio, were near down below the norm. I mean, they were down around 25-30% were pet friendly, whereas Portland, Seattle, Denver, even Philadelphia were above 75%. And you would think that percentage would reflect household percentage that have pets, right? Roughly. And so I am in Columbus quite often. I work a lot with Ohio State and with other businesses in the Columbus area. So I know Columbus and like Columbus very much, though I'm a Pac-12 guy. Let me just make that very clear. I'm from the West. But anyway, I came back and I didn't redo the study, but in 2020 before or late 19 and early 20 before COVID hammered us, I went back to Columbus and did what study I could. And in that 5 years, as you know, living there, Columbus expensive, cool millennial apartment buildings just popped up everywhere.
Right.
The Short North area was the most prominent. And what did developers figure out in those 5 years? If you want to rent to millennials, you're pet friendly. If you don't want to do that, don't build an apartment complex. Don't even think about it. And it had changed that fast.
Wow.
And I used Columbus a lot because this was not this gradual surge over 25 years. It spiked, was level, and then it took off again as millennials, you know, out of college, as you say, had jobs. And I don't think they chose pets over having children. They just timed things differently. But the main thing was they were going to have a pet. I mean, they hadn't decided yet about kids, but for sure they're going to have pets. And I went into a number of Short North apartments. And the developers just said, it wouldn't occur to us to not be pet friendly. We're not even restricting the size of dogs, the number, you know, whatever millennials want, they can have, because they'll pay for it too. Right. I mean, you know, they'll pay that extra $20 a month a pet fee. So it's changed dramatically. What hasn't changed, and it's not a good thing at all, public housing, particularly federally financed, is supposed to be pet friendly. And you'd be surprised the number of public apartments, including in Ohio, but all over this country, don't let people in with pets. And there's a sense somehow, well, they can't afford dogs. No, yes, they can. If they have a dog, that means they can afford one. So, and if there's any cohort of our culture that probably needs companionship more, it would be low-income people that can't access other amenities. And I'm working on that. That's a real priority of a lot of people right now, is to address that issue, including the cost of vet care tied mm-hmm. to that, but just the ability to be in an apartment. There's a story, breaks my heart still thinking about it, of a good friend of mine knew this fellow that lived under a bridge in Napa, California. Now, if you're going to live under a bridge, that's probably the part of the country to do that, but I don't want to be a smart aleck. And he had a large dog, and he finally won the housing lottery to get into a new public housing project. He goes to the project to check into his room that he gets to finally have with his dog, and he's told, sorry, no dog. So where do you think he lives today?
Under the bridge?
You know, under the bridge. He's not going to take his best friend and walk him to a shelter. So we could do a lot more there, and you know, and I think it'll happen, but too slow right now for my taste.
My guest is Mark Cushing. He's founder and CEO of the Animal Policy Group. It advocates for animal health and the veterinary profession in the U.S. His book is titled Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. From 1998 to 2018, the total annual amount of money spent on pets in the U.S. increased from $23 billion, this is shocking, to $90.5 billion. We're looking at how pets and our love of them has evolved and how that relationship is affecting us politically, economically, and socially. Our guest is Mark Cushing. He considers these questions in his book, Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Mark, when you talk about culture, what do you mean by the influence or how this pet ownership and the scale of pet ownership affects our culture?
Culture to me is what's common outside the home among, you know, Americans in the U.S. or Canadians in Canada, the kind of the lives that we intersect when we leave, but also what we spend our money on and how do we spend our time inside our home. And to the extent that that's something we share, it's not just, you know, seeing your own family photo book or something. And that's where pets have become center stage. And, you know, and people will say, well, pets are the new children. I always, you know, my response is that's an insult to pets. You know, they have a much better deal than the kids, and they don't have a teenage phase. And to your intro, the number now, we spent last year $110 billion on pets, and Morgan Stanley says by 2028 or 29, so basically 7 to 8 years from now, we'll be right below $300 billion, almost tripling it from now to then in less than a decade. So to the point that we're not a fad and we're not running out of interest. But one of the things about the culture is the workplace. this study was done by Nationwide Pet, you know, in from Columbus. It was with a PhD researcher, Carrie O'Hara, a good friend of mine. And it was remarkable. I mean, it has flipped people's thinking upside down. It took 1,500 pet owners, 1,500 workers across the country, 1,000 owned pets, 500 didn't. And it explored in depth every way you could ask it how they viewed their company, if it was pet friendly or not. If it was pet friendly, everybody, including non-pet owners, significantly liked their company better. They liked their coworkers better. And listen to this, bosses, they liked their bosses better if the place was pet friendly. Lots of theories about why the latter would be true. I think probably the boss just couldn't be a jerk around a dog and not get, got tossed out the window. So, but it really got people thinking about, is there any place pets can't go and couldn't go? And with COVID hopefully receding to the extent that, you know, people are trying to pull employees back into offices, particularly in corporate cities like Columbus, one of the bargaining issues is people's attachment to their pets and their decision, I'm not leaving my dog or cat all day. I'm just not doing it. So the starting point with you and me negotiating here is it's not every day I'm in your office. So let's, and that's, I think pets are maybe the biggest club people have, so to speak, in negotiating that issue.
So what, and you made me think of club, you know, what about people who don't like pets, who are not dog or cat friendly, who think this is all ridiculous? It's obviously a shrinking percentage of the American populace when 7 out of 10 own a dog or cat, but what about them? Are they not in the club?
Well, they're not in that club, but I have...
Do we trust them?
There's an anecdote. There's a great hotel group. I don't know if they have a hotel in Columbus. It's called the Kempton Group. They don't name every hotel Kempton, mm-hmm. but they began in San Francisco. They're nationwide, and they're kind of a cool, hip chain, but really fun to stay in. And Kempton's now, in most of their hotels, have a special floor for non-pet owners. Now, who'd have thought? I mean, if I told you that 20 years ago, man, you'd have said, are you crazy? You mean a non-pet owner floor? Like pets are everywhere else? Yeah, mm-hmm. Pets are everywhere else. And you have to respect people with allergies and so forth. And that makes the air travel issue still very contentious. That may be as contentious as any issue. But, you know, people that don't like pets just don't like them. Allergies not part of the equation. They're losing the battle, and I don't see that backing up. And I do think we'll get to the stage that Paris has been in forever, where people bring their dogs right into the restaurant inside, and that's still forbidden in most American cities and most restaurants. They just aren't comfortable. But watch that change in the next 5-10 years.
Well, they've always used public health issue, you know, public health concerns as the reason why. Is that valid or not?
Yeah, I mean, you can paint a picture that said that would be valid, but the French find a way to survive. And mainly it's like so many things, dogs are just better behaved today. Why? Because owners have invested time and money and effort into training. And I think people would have a way to realize they need to get outside with their dog fairly quickly because, you know, something's about to happen. You don't want to happen. But but I mean, there are restaurants in the U.S. that are pet friendly all the way. It's not common, but my guess is that's the last bastion. Maybe church and restaurants will be the last refuge of non-pet owners, and that'll soon vanish.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Mark Cushing. He's founder and CEO of the Animal Policy Group, which advocates for animal health and the veterinary profession in the U.S. His book is titled Pet Nation, the inside story of how companion animals are transforming our homes, culture, and economy. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Amelia and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Amelia.
Hi. I'm not hearing anything about rescue animals. And I've been involved with rescue for about 10 years locally. And we're seeing a huge influx again of animals into the shelters. The shelters are popping because they're so full of animals. And because people are returning to work and are not locked down with COVID, we don't have as many fosters. So the rescues are begging for fosters again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see this, you know, positivity that y'all are screeching about. I'm seeing dogs who are still, you know, abandoned, abused, neglected, turned into shelters, picked up as strays. Maybe the culture is slowly changing, but there are still plenty of animals out there that are suffering, and they need rescues, and shelters need to be unloaded of dogs. We need lots of fosters. We need people who will help.
Well, yeah, Amelia, I just hadn't gotten to it yet. I'm glad you brought it up. Yeah, Mark.
I'm happy to comment on that. That's simply not the case nationally. There are pockets of the country where that is true. And I'm sorry, you know, obviously that's not a good situation. And I don't doubt where you are and the rescue you work with or have some involvement with, that that's the case. But those are isolated examples now. That's what's changed. The most northern shelters are basically empty of adoptable dogs by noon on Friday, if not noon on Saturdays. Most get their dogs from the South, lower Texas or Southwest. Portland, Oregon's a good example. They get two shipments a week up from Los Angeles Animal Control in Bakersfield, California. Those situations there were, you know, too many dogs. They were at risk of euthanasia, exactly as you might expect. But they get to Portland, they're spay and neutered, they're in good shape, and in a day they're gone. I mean, if you get to the Oregon Humane Society afternoon on Friday, you have no chance of finding a dog. And that's true generally across the North, but there are exceptions. So I don't want to debate your case. I haven't seen it, but I'm sure it's true. So I'm not disputing it. But we've had, and I know this from talking to shelter leaders across the country, which I do on a regular basis, and their circumstances have changed. I think it's a myth in general, not exceptions, always exceptions, but it's a myth that millennials are going to take dogs they've fallen in love with over the last year and a half and go back to a shelter and say, here, Sparky, good luck. I hope you don't get euthanized. I hope you find a home. I mean, that's basically not the nature of the human animal bond, that you're able to do that, you know, callously and without, you know, any empathy. So I don't think that's chronic, but obviously, in your situation, it's a problem.
Well, I mean, Amelia also brought up the issue of neglect and abuse, and that's part of this phenomenon, too. I mean, it's always been and it always will be. There's people abuse each other. They neglect each other, let alone their pets.
A lot of data, and it's worse than that and peer-reviewed, you know, scientific research, that many male adult domestic violence felons mm-hmm. got their start abusing animals.
Right.
My daughter prosecutes adult sexual assault felonies in the West Coast. And when I shared that, she said, that's absolutely true. You know, we almost always find that there's animal abuse in the background. And states are funny. I can't remember right now where Ohio is on this, but you'd be surprised the number of major states that don't obligate a veterinarian to report suspicions of animal abuse. Many states do, and they give you legal protection so you can't get sued by the pet owner, who's obviously not happy to have somebody show up at the door and say, you know, we understand you may, you know, have a dog abuse situation or cat abuse. But that ought to be 100% of the states. There shouldn't be a single state that doesn't, you know, trigger veterinarians the same way human doctors, you know, human doctors have an obligation. You see a child mm-hmm. and you look at bruises and you can't explain what the proverbial they fell off the counter, you know, excuse that we often hear from, you know, felons that do that kind of thing. And it shouldn't be any different for pets. I'm always surprised. In my book, I show the map. In fact, I have the book handy. Having said all that, I ought to see where Ohio was, right? Let me just see if I can.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure what that is, but I've known somebody.
Oh, you know what? I'm surprised. It's not mandatory in Ohio. Mm-hmm. It is in Pennsylvania, West Virginia. I'm just picking mm-hmm. areas around you, Illinois, Wisconsin. It's voluntary, meaning that if you choose to report it in Ohio, you're protected legally, but there's not an obligation. It's not an obligation in New York. That's embarrassing. Georgia, big state. Texas is like Ohio. California, Oregon, Colorado. It's interesting. It's at least 25 states, at least half don't require it. So it's a work in progress.
Ohio is also, and Amelia, thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it. It's obviously a very worthy topic. And in some place, you know, there are always exceptions to the rule. Ohio is also considered very, very friendly to pet. What am I trying to say now? Breeding situations, like mass breeding situations. There aren't any rules and regulations, or very few, very little to control puppy mills.
Ohio does have animal welfare regulations. It does have those. I wouldn't agree that it doesn't have them. There are large breeders that are humane, and there are small breeders that aren't, and there's large breeders that aren't too. And I think one problem I highlight in the book is that we've painted a broad brush and said, if you're a large scale breeder, you're bad. You're doing bad things to dogs. And there's just a lot of evidence that's not the case. But breeders do not trust anybody in general, and they're behind laurel hedges, and you don't know what's going on behind it. And I think the biggest issue, Ann, is transparency. Think about zoos. If zoos today looked like they looked 30 years ago, animal rights group would have shut them down in an hour because they were basically jail cells. What's a jail? Concrete room with metal bars. Okay, that was the Portland, Oregon Zoo. You had the bear cell, the tiger cell, the lion cell, you know, and it was very depressing. And one of the things zoos did besides make the environment more interesting and, you know, attempting to be natural, but they also invited the media, they invited schools, they invited people behind the stage to say, look at how we do things here. And frankly, it had a huge effect. I mean, today more people attend zoos than NFL football games in the country. I heard that number and thought that's impossible.
Well, it's cheaper. it's cheaper, getting more expensive, but it is cheaper. You know, to Amelia's point and to this other point about millennials adopting, I mean, earlier this year, the New York Times reported that some pet adoptions are akin to adopting a child, requiring background checks and home visits of prospective animal adoptees. And when we're talking about not just adoptions, but buying pets, I mean, the better breeders will not let their puppies out to just anybody with $1,500 or $2,000 or whatever the going rate is for that breed. They want to make sure they're going to a safe home and a responsible home. And that, all things being equal, is part of what cuts down on recidivism for the shelters and abuse and neglect of a dog or a cat or whatever.
Yeah, it does. It remains a very complicated issue because nearly 300 cities have banned pet stores from selling puppies. Most puppies are sold on the internet now, unless it's a local purchase. You might see on Craigslist or something in Columbus, you know, you'll see people that have dog for sale, but internet sales aren't any safer than pet store sales in one sense, those bans in a number of states, it doesn't even matter if you could prove you're from a good breeder. They do not want puppies sold in a pet store environment because of the association with puppy mills. So where we are right now is we have over a million dogs coming into the country from outside the U.S. borders, of which only 3% have any medical records whatsoever, veterinary or vaccine records. It's good that those dogs get a home, and the caller that talked about rescues, a number of rescues almost entirely are devoted to foreign dogs. They hear about a problem in Puerto Rico or a problem somewhere, and they bring in, you know, 30 dogs. And they have diseases, they have issues that we don't normally see or at the prevalence that these dogs have. And that's complicated. I mean, you know, that's the story I tell, that Pet Nation isn't all just happy miniature versions of Lassie running around America, being polite to their neighbors and so forth. I mean, there are consequences, you know, to the pet culture we have.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll continue our conversation. My guest is Mark Cushing. He's founder and CEO of the Animal Policy Group. His book is titled Pet Nation, The Inside Story of How Companion Animals Are Transforming Our Homes, Culture, and Economy. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about pet culture in the United States. My guest is Mark Cushing, founding partner and CEO of the Animal Policy Group. His book is titled Pet Nation, The Inside Story of How Companion Animals Are Transforming Our Homes, Culture, and Economy. If you have a call, if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have, you know, the pandemic saw an increase in animal adoptions to the point that some animal shelters were emptied last year. But people have to return to work now, and we're talking about how they prepare their pets for life around the house. Or we were talking about that earlier. We have a call from Molly. Molly, you have a solution, or you found a solution to your problem. Hi, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. Yes, I am the typical COVID millennial. My husband and I purchased our puppy, a very hyper breed. We love him very much, and we work from home about 3 days a week, but still needed him to have positive interactions with other dogs without us being in small groups of people. So we loved our doggy daycare that we found during my call screening. I told the individual that it was kind of like trying to get a child in our private school system. That's how difficult it was, but we love it. It's been a great source of relief, and I didn't know if your guest had any comments on that. Thank you.
Yeah. Mark Cushing?
Yeah, I do. That's interesting. Congratulations. And fortunately, your story is more typical than exceptional in the sense that dog, and by the way, daycare and boarding facilities were the only part of the pet economic world that was hammered during COVID. You can picture why, right? People were home. They didn't need to use them. They weren't traveling. They didn't need to board their pets. Everything else in the pet world had the best year and a half they've ever had financially, which is nothing we expected to happen, but it did. But they're back up and running, and I think eager to have, you know, clients. And it's a good solution. You know, you have obviously due diligence that I'm sure you and your husband did to make sure that the standards, you know, the trainers they have and so forth were, you know, met your requirements. But it's a good option. And it's funny, you know, it's a friend of mine the other day, with a really good friend I work with, her one-year-old son is in daycare every day from 8 to 5. And I said to her, this isn't pet story, but you think about the analogy. And I said, how's that work? Is that a pretty dramatic, you know, goodbye in the morning and a very dramatic hello in the afternoon? And she said, he loves it. These are his buddies. You know, he hangs out all day with his friends that look like him, and they're his size. And dogs do that. The challenge with daycare with dogs I've seen is, hopefully it's a facility that separates by size. Our puppy, we have two cats and a puppy, and our puppy, he could not be in a daycare with big dogs. And he's got the little dog syndrome. So he'd try to pick a fight, and that wouldn't go so well with him. So that's one of the dynamics that, but I think more and more kennels and daycare scenarios know that. And they're obviously trying to minimize excitement as well, but I'm glad you've had a good experience. I'm also glad your husband gets to work at home 3 days a week. I'm sure that's appreciated by the dog, too.
Vicki in Columbus, you're on the air, and you wanted to talk about House Bill 33. I'm glad you called.
Yes, thank you. Hello, Mark and Ann. I'm Vicki Teasner, and I'm the Government Affairs Representative in Ohio for Animal Welfare Institute out of D.C., and I'm also the Executive Director of Ohio Animal Advocates. And personally, I'm aware of this because I was the one that worked on it,
yeah.
And I'm sure it's recent, so Mark, you didn't know. House Bill 33 that passed last year was signed by the governor on the 6th of January and became effective on April 12th. Actually, it's one of the most comprehensive cross-reporting bills in the nation. It requires social workers, counselors, therapists, and veterinarians to report animal abuse mandatory with civil and criminal immunity and sanctions. And it also requires dog wardens, animal control officers, and law enforcement to report child malfeasance and elder abuse.
That's great to hear. And I, in my book was published before that bill passed.
Yeah.
And when I looked at my map, I was obviously looking at the map that reflected life in 2019. So I'm trying to publicize the need for just that kind of legislation to be passed. So congratulations. Ohio has a terrific VMA, the Veterinary Medical Association, run by Jack Advent, probably does as good a job as any veterinary group in the country. And Ohio State is one of the top five vet schools in the country. And so there is an animal welfare culture in the state. I'm not saying it's perfect, but you have a lot of professionals and a lot of volunteers and people like yourselves that are professionals that are there in all different parts of the system. And I always point people to Ohio. That's why I was surprised. I remember when I saw it was voluntary, not mandatory, mm-hmm. but that's a good step forward.
Vicki, thank you so much for the call. I really appreciate that. And you know, I remember you made me think of something else, Mark Cushing, and that is when I've been at MedVet or, you know, any emergency room for your pet. You in Columbus, obviously, we're spoiled rotten because of Ohio State, and MedVet is based here and it's huge. And mm-hmm. I routinely, when I've been in there, have met people from two and three states away that have traveled very long distances to get veterinary care for their dog who's in some kind of crisis or cat or whatever. And I guess we have an embarrassment of riches here. It's not that way for everybody. And I'm wondering how this influx of pets and this, how this whole trend is affecting people who live maybe not so close and don't have the access to the same kinds of facilities. And
well, first of all, yes, congratulations to the great institutions in Columbus, but you have a shortage of veterinarians in Columbus, believe it or not. You have difficulty getting appointments, getting seen in emergency clinics, even in Columbus. Mm-hmm. I know that firsthand. Other areas are worse. The most serious problem in the entire pet world right now in the United States is the shortage of veterinarians and veterinary nurses or vet techs, as they're called. And it's an acute shortage. So you have a lot of urban areas where it's a 48-hour wait to get into an emergency clinic, which means it's no longer an emergency clinic. If your dog's hit by a car, you know, you don't wait two days. And I did recent interviews with Fox LA and ABC San Francisco on that shortage issue, driven by the producers knowing or having friends whose dogs had died because they couldn't get in to see vets. So we went 36 years from 1978 to 2014 in this country, and we opened one vet school. So today you have 185 medical schools in America and 33 vet schools. And it's never been more true that it's harder to get in the vet school than it is to get in the medical school. And it's, even though incomes are getting closer, students' starting salaries because of the shortage are going up dramatically. You're seeing signing bonuses that were never a possibility just 3, 4, 5 years ago, but it's a real problem and it's a burnout factor. And you have a vet nurse profession that's not paid adequately. I don't hesitate to say that. They're just not paid for, and they're not utilized at the full scale of their board certified training. And it's a mistake. It's been driven by veterinarians fearful of competition and fearful of paying too much. And I think now if they could, they'd say, good God, we'll how do we make it up? But you can't turn that ship around quickly. It's a real challenge. But Ohio is blessed. But I just want to say that I happen to know that even with its major powerhouse hospitals and staffs, there aren't enough.
Carl in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I've been interested in pets a long time. Since 1971, I've lived with 22 dogs.
Oh, my goodness.
As many as eight at once.
Okay, I thought you were. I thought you meant all at once, 22. Okay, go on.
Yeah, they have a term for that.
Well, it started with one dog, and then there was a successor and a successor to that. And then I had Inga the Great. And this is leading to a point on what you can learn from your pets. Inga the Great, she was a hyperactive, super athletic genius. You could watch her think and learn. And so I spent $2,000 to have puppies. And that was a handful. Eight crazy puppies and the mother. But one of the things I have found is that you can, if you have questions, you can ask your dog friends. Point is that I used to be down around the OSU area, and many of the dog walkers were faculty. So I could ask questions like, what is a PhD? And I was answered by Dewey, the Airedale's owner, who was on the faculty at OSU in philosophy, and he could give an authoritative answer. So dogs give you access to other people.
Yep.
More stories than that. But another thing I learned was the genetic connection to behavior. Dogs are bred for a purpose, like terriers or herding dogs, and you can see it.
Mm-hmm.
Down at the Como Dog, Como Park.
Well, let me, Carl, just stop you there, because I think you've brought up an interesting thing. And I'm wondering, Mark Cushing, if people are becoming more sophisticated when they go out to pick a dog. It's shocking to me sometimes what people will do. They'll get a herding dog when the dog's going to be in their apartment with them half the day. You know, they're not going to be getting them enough exercise, or they get a small dog that barks a lot and it irritates their eardrums. I mean, are people getting better at that?
Oh, I think they're getting better, but, you know, culture, people are, you know, people's choices are so variable in what drove them. A friend had a dog and they loved that dog, and suddenly, and they go over there and they just think that's a great species, and they that's the dog they want. New York, where my brother lives, I mean, you see some of the biggest dogs in America come out of apartments where they must have been at most 800 square feet.
Yeah.
And, they make it work, but it does puzzle you. I will say this: we have a lap dog, a small dog now, a Papillon, and I never thought I'd have a Papillon. I sort of was used to bigger dogs, and you can move them around. They're maneuverable, right? You can be in a public space and pick them up and carry them away from a dog that's getting excited nearby, right? And when you've got a German Shepherd, that's a little tougher. Tougher job. So it's funny how people pick dogs. There are great services that match up, you know, lifestyle needs and behavioral profiles, but yeah, I guess they're dating services for pets, you know, and really that was a model people used. And I suspect they work well. I've never had any involvement with that.
You know, you reminded me earlier on when you were talking about the influence of media on pet ownership, and it reminded me of the Frasier dog, the Jack Russell Terrier on that TV show, and there was a real huge increase in people getting Jack Russell Terriers, thinking they were all going to be perfectly trained, and look how smart they are, and they're very difficult dogs to have. Any smart dog is difficult.
Yeah, Eddie's dog, and he's right up there with, you know, Lassie, in terms of just how fun was it when Eddie showed up on the couch, and you just knew that the next 60 seconds was going to be entertaining. But Jack Russells are a special breed. A friend of mine, you know, had a Jack Russell that attacked and jumped on the back of a coyote. Now that, you know, that's a serious dog that you see a coyote. Guess what? My Papillon puppy a week ago here in Arizona, where I live, did this. He went after a coyote. I mean, I ran behind him, but he saw a big dog in his mind. I was like, yeah, I'm going to get you off my property. Well, not a good idea. We are a little bit more attuned to that now, but it's an interesting, yes, dogs are, as are cats, you know, the great phrase is dogs have owners and cats have staff. I mean, cats look at us with, to me, a delightful contempt. I mean, just, we have two cats, and I enjoy them in part because of how contemptuous they can be of humans, but they'll tolerate us.
Yeah, we didn't get to a lot of other animal species, and I'm sorry for that. I knew we would run out of time before I got to everything. But Mark Cushing, thanks so much for your time that you did give us today. I really appreciate it.
Enjoy. Good luck.
Thank you. Mark Cushing, founder and CEO of Animal Policy Group, which advocates for animal health and the veterinary profession in the U.S. He's also author of the book Pet Nation, The Inside Story of How Companion Animals Are Transforming Our Homes, Culture, and Economy. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for the great calls. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.